Iran today.
In Iran, you see restaurants serving unlimited amounts of bread next to whatever meal one might order. And the yogurt and cheese to go with the bread don't normally come plain. Rose petal, pistachios, and walnuts blend well if you know how to apply them. Correct. We are here to talk about Iran's agricultural resources today. Agricultural sustainability and independence, rather, in the face of U.S. maximum pressure sanctions. Because, yes, the sanctions are still in place, and they're even affecting food and drug availability. Stay with me, Leila Faraman, is here on Iran Today to see how Iran, this mini-continent of four seasons, is doing. Iran's present situation is fine for the short term, but longer-term planning is a must to maintain and improve suitable arable water levels and soil quality, foreign policy, and people's purchasing power. Disjointed as these factors may sound, they all come together to make for foodstuff availability and security, and a lucrative food industry. Mr. Kiani Rod is in a position to plan strategy for the country's agricultural sector and market. He explains the tenets of a successful chain, beginning with production and ending in consumption.
Food security has four main pillars. The first pillar of the debate is availability, meaning that food must be available in the required amount. It goes without saying that the agricultural sector needs resources and agricultural components to produce food, perhaps the most important of which are basic resources such as soil, water, biodiversity, and other factors of production, including the productive components, machinery, and so on.
Aye, for as long as produce is delivered to the market on time and not hoarded to raise prices, and for as long as people can afford it, there still is enough crop yielded to keep stomachs full and keep Iranian cuisine alive. The FAO announced the production of over 21.5 million tons of grain in Iran during the last crop year, and announced that Iran is ranked 9th in the world in terms of grain reserves. Achieving this rank while the country is exposed to drought is commendable. With 17th place in terms of population in the world, Iran has 1.1% of the world's grain reserves. Mr. Khalilian is a former agriculture minister. He has some figures handy to present.
Fortunately, during the 4 decades since the Islamic Republic was founded, we have been able to meet more than 80% of our agricultural needs in food. Especially on products such as wheat, we have managed to become relatively self-sufficient for some years. In the years when we faced drought, we met at least 80% of our wheat needs from the inside. In the field of dairy products, rice and some other strategic products, we have been able to achieve relative self-sufficiency and even managed to export $5 to $6 billion a year in various agricultural products.
The wheat harvest has actually decreased by 500,000 tons in the last crop year. However, the rice harvest has increased by 200,000 tons and other grains have grown by 200,000 tons as well. Iran's staple diet is wheat, barley and rice. Ms. Rafi saves room for praise for improvement. She's on the Parliamentary Agricultural Committee and has the qualification to amend the legal system to improve Iran's status in the sector.
Unfortunately, we are over 70% dependent on inputs. This is not called strategic agriculture for a country. When we have to import seeds, when we have to import pesticides and fertilizers to a large extent, we have to import livestock and fish feed inputs. This means incomplete and improper planning in the field of agriculture.
The United Nations Food and Agriculture Organization, FAO, had estimated the area under wheat cultivation in Iran would increase slightly in 2020. Plantation area is around 6 million hectares right now. Iran is basically on the Iranian plateau and is at high altitude. The country comprises 14% arable land, 8% forest, and 55% natural pastures, and 23% desert. The pastures are non-arable, by the way.
One of the major projects undertaken in the Islamic Republic was the Agricultural Development Project, which we have been pursuing since 2010. We provided 9 trillion tomans of cheap credits and facilities to farmers, and we also helped new investors to invest in various fields with low-interest facilities.
In March 2020, the government announced its plans to purchase nearly 75% of the domestic wheat production. The aim was to eliminate the reliance on imports for domestic consumption. With all the talk of domestic consumption, it's easy to lose sight of the importance of exports. Now, sanctions may well be in the way of exports, and what a shame, given Iran's high-quality, varied produce. Before going on to exports, however, I would like to tend more to the importance of improving the farming and agriculture sector. That can be helped by foreign investment and introducing more technology into farming in Iran. Having managed, followed and managed water resources, however. As per any sector, exports must move, however, from raw sales to the sale of processed material and standardly packed, preferably organic foodstuff and food products. Mr. Sheikhi is an economist who can list as many impediments to exports as there are letters in the alphabet. Here are some of those reasons.
Unfortunately, Iran has a very small share in the global agricultural market, which is also a lucrative one. This is because, unfortunately, we have not, and still do not have, an integrated trade policy system based on the model of a resistive economy. I will mention some of the problems here on a case-by-case basis. One of the problems is bureaucracy. The second is a lack of coordination between organs. And furthermore, we don't have a specific body that is responsible for the export of agricultural products.
The government had wanted to attract $8 billion over 4 years by foreign investment in the agricultural sector. That was before the 2015 JCPOA, or nuclear deal, which would have facilitated just that by lifting sanctions off Iran in return for this country limiting its peaceful nuclear program. But before the contents of the deal could materialize, the U.S. pulled out and reimposed and reinforced economic nuclear-related U.N. sanctions as U.S. sanctions.
Foreign investment in our country has not been very successful. There are several reasons for that, some of which are internal and others external and out of our control. Internal reasons include the problem of bureaucratic processes in the country, which makes it somewhat difficult to invest. I can use the term self-sanctioning to describe it. The issue of foreign sanctions has also had its impacts. More important than sanctions is the issue of investment security and the feeling of investment security. We are the safest country in the Middle East. Some admit this, some do not. But the media propaganda tries to undermine the perception of this security.
As for exports again, Iran's share in the international market is pretty low in spite of its present resources and future potential. Its share in the global market is at under 5%. FAO says threats should be turned around into opportunities to turn small-scale farming into macro farming. The infrastructure, after all, is present given Iran's variety of terrains, which make for four seasons to exist simultaneously. They also make for a varied influx of produce all the year round.
We're at the crossroads of the north, south, and east-west trade corridors. This crossroads can be a special place for us in exporting products that are cultivated and created through investment in our country. Energy is abundant in this country. We have a lot of renewable energy. In addition to being one of the world's leading oil and gas producers and having huge reserves, we have renewable energy that can be used organically without generating pollution and with the lowest pollution costs to serve the production and investment. We also have a large and young workforce.
Talking of infrastructure, Iran's Qanat irrigated agricultural heritage systems made Iran the most fertile area in the history of Asia. There was once mass production of grains as well as sugarcane and date palm. And today, just in 2004, Iran's wheat yield reached 14 million tons. This made the country more than self-sufficient as far as land yield goes. It ended the country's 45-year history of importing wheat. Also, it saved the country $1 billion a year in overseas expenditures. Iran may have lost the European market in spite of the high quality of its exports, but it is still exporting to countries such as Iraq, Azerbaijan, and Afghanistan. Iran is the world's biggest producer of pistachio and saffron. Apart from those two products, exports of other agricultural commodities like apples, milk, and vegetables are not economically viable for Iranian exporters. Regarding Iran's agricultural resources, what they entail, and what more must be done about them, there's more to be said. But first, a media review with Shahrzad.
Hi, my name is Shahrzad Manoucheri, and we'll be reviewing the latest update on food security amid sanctions, Iran's untapped agricultural potentials. In an article by Tehran Times, we explore soil depletion, a neglected issue requiring urgent attention. Soil is one of the most vital non-renewable resources that many organisms on the planet depend on, as it ensures food security of the nations. However, the attention paid to this valuable resource is not as much as its significance. According to the latest statistics, Iran loses 2 billion tons of soil annually, which according to the 2018 report of the United Nations Development Program, the total amount of global soil erosion is 24 billion tons, so 1/12 of all global soil erosion occurs in Iran. This is while Iran has about 1% of the world's land area, which means that its erosion rate is 8 times higher than the global average, so Iran is suffering from severe degradation and soil erosion. To understand the importance of soil protection, it should be said that it takes an average of 400 years to form a centimeter of soil on the planet. Horti Daily reports Iran's food self-sufficiency reaches 81%. Qasem Khabazi, acting Minister of Agriculture of Iran, said, "For the coming year, we have seen the supply of all inputs such as seeds, fertilizers, pesticides, and livestock and poultry supplements, vaccines and serums, and a good work environment." He also added that we have a very close relationship with farmers, and the wheat cultivation program is 6% more than that of last year, and barley cultivation is 16% higher than last year, and rapeseed cultivation is 14% higher than last year. He then added, our self-sufficiency in the food production reached 81% last year, and our forecast is that this number will increase and reach 83% this year, thanks to the efforts of farmers. Tehran Times states Persian Gulf Water Transfer Project inaugurated. In recent years, due to increasing water consumption for drinking, industrial and agricultural purposes, and sometimes consecutive droughts, the central plateau of Iran has been experiencing severe water shortages, especially in big cities like Isfahan, Kerman, Yazd, and Hormozgan. President Hassan Rouhani inaugurated the first phase of Iran's major water desalination and transfer project, which is aimed at supplying Persian Gulf water to central Iran through pipelines. This project is aimed at transmitting Persian Gulf water to Hormozgan, Kerman, and Yazd provinces after being desalinated in a modern desalination plant. With the implementation of this project, the country's desalination capacity is going to increase by 50%. This project aims to promote production, industry, and agriculture, as well as to provide drinkable water to residents in arid areas. Maintaining the country's food security and creating new job opportunities, and also maintaining the already existing jobs in industrial and production units, are also other merits of the mentioned project. That's all for this segment. We'll see you next week.
In general, Iran's major agricultural exports include fresh and dried fruits, nuts, animal hide, processed foods, caviar, and spices. From the standpoint of value, pistachio, raisins, dates, and saffron are the first four export products. On the relatively new bell pepper farm you've seen me in so far, I got to talk to the farmer who set up his business with a look to exports as well as domestic supply.
From the beginning, I looked at the market, and in Iran nowadays, this product is consumed better, and it is also against the some kind of cancers. So we have to have it in our food, I think. We are exporting more than half of our products to, for example, Russia and in the Persian Gulf region. I think 10% is for domestic use and 90% for export.
A danger to both self-sufficiency and exports that bring foreign currency into the country is unaccounted for imports and exports. That is to say, when people's most basic need becomes a source of astronomical income to the few, and the balance between these three variables is tipped over. Imports, exports, and domestic produce for domestic use.
Our Ministry of Industry, Mining and Trade is structured so that it's more willing to import in this regard. The desire to import is extremely high. The interests of many traders, dominating the country's markets and product supply, hinder the development of exports. There are some brokers who are mainly looking for imports because that's how they generate money. Being able to attain licensing for imports and exports is a public right. It must not be given to just a select few. Licenses must be granted to productive cooperatives.
The agricultural sector's share in Iran's non-oil gross domestic product, GDP, reached 8.8% in the previous Iranian calendar year. That's up 3% over 7 years. Once again, the Iranian calendar year begins on March the 21st. There is room for more growth in the agriculture sector, however, by using modern science and new technologies and methods, both technically and in the commercial sector.
In two ways, I think we are going forward. One of them is academical studies, and these academical studies helps us to become a farmer, because I'm not a farmer's son. I'm only an agriculture engineer, but I decided to make this. And the other thing is the sanctions, I think, because these sanctions causes us to pushes us to do it by ourselves.
Now, in spite of all the talk on mechanizing or further modernizing farming, the gardening business, as one branch of the industry, boasts it has mechanized enough to have produced more crop at higher quality and lower, more competitive costs. The agricultural sector at large, however, must become more demand-orientated than supply-orientated in order to make better engineered profit from sales. This is although Iran claims over 95% of the technology and knowledge in this area, that's mechanization, is domestic. A shortcoming for the country is the agricultural industry falls short of raw material production, be it growing grain and fruit or husbanding cattle and farming fish. Gardening has contributed significantly to non-oil exports and creating employment. With an evolved related industry, including packaging methods, it can do yet better.
The ground for attracting foreign investment for agricultural development is provided. Foreigners can make good profits if they invest in fields such as packaging, processing of agricultural products, and many other areas. The point is that Iran is a secure country, and I think investors should take that into consideration. The Iranian government guarantees their original capital and the profit thereof.
Now we can toil all we want, but with climate change and population growth, and now a viral pandemic at large, planning is key to carrying on. Crops and the sustenance and money they secure can only be guaranteed by the health of Mother Earth, her water and soil.
Over the past centuries, due to population growth and the need for food, and not only in Iran but all over the world, we had to take the water out of the ground, build a variety of dams, and allocate more for the urban and industrial use and less for the agricultural sector. failure to control water consumption patterns in the drinking and industrial sector, locating water-demanding industries such as steel factories away from parts of Iran like the north and the south where we have huge water resources, and instead running them in deserts in central Iran, have all been policies that have jeopardized the country's water balance and water security.
The UN's Food and Agriculture Organization, FAO, is out to help Iran in this regard, while Iran itself is investing in its youth at knowledge-based companies. This is of paramount importance given major water resources have been desiccated by overuse and excessive deep well digging, beginning with the administration past.
We have no choice but to invest in technology and knowledge-based institutions. The sanctions target both our foreign investment and our ability to import the technology we need. The solution is to take steps similar to other countries that have been sanctioned and threatened. They have relied on domestic resources and not on capital and technology coming from abroad.
The role of watershed management and water distribution management in achieving important statistics in the field of agriculture is significant, but there is yet work to be done. FAO has a project to implement in Iran to assist this country in rehabilitating its soil and water resources and enhancing the resilience of the agriculture system and rural communities, resilience to climate change and climatic disasters. Now, two important water resources to replenish are the Qazvin Plain and Urmia Lake Basin. A prerequisite to doing so is water accounting and mapping evapotranspiration. Water accounting is the process of collecting, analyzing, summarizing, and reporting water-related information. It reveals how water is used across different sectors and helps shape and understand the benefits and existing trade-off of the water allocations and use patterns. And the integrated and cross-sectoral presentation of the information on water accounting helps users, that's decision makers, see the bigger picture. It is important to assess and map agroecological zones and water availability to develop appropriate crop patterns. The development and implementation of different crop patterns contributes to higher land productivity, in other words, increased crop production.
We have several points of view in the Agriculture Commission. One is why, for example, the main livestock feed in our country should be corn, which we can't grow inside Iran. There are plants and fodder that can be grown anywhere without special care in our country, which has a hot and dry climate. We must have an approach toward non-dependency on some inputs. It's not like we make a decision this year and reap the rewards next year. But we can make the right decisions for the coming years, which I think will have a positive outcome.
It is noteworthy as far as self-sufficiency in production and supply goes, the matter of comparative advantage shouldn't be overlooked, hard as that may be with sanctions in place. Because to produce all one needs will in the long term only exhaust the infrastructure to produce agricultural requirements more than it already has. All matters considered, it's the farmer that has to put theory into practice. Our farmer, who is young, unlike a great many, has also, thanks to his college education, fully mechanized his plantation.
In lots of aspects, they are different. One of them is that we have a 7-meter height, and everything is controlled by the smart climate control system, which helps us to use less people to help us, and we are doing these kind of things by hand in the other farms, but in this farm everything is automatically done.
FAO is holding an e-learning program in Iran to equip experts with the knowledge and skills to implement REWAS, REWAS. That's the advanced approach of real water savings. The approach uses the concept of following the water. Given this concept, drainage, runoff, and percolation to the underground are no longer losses, because downstream users can use these recoverable waters. This beauty spot is going to make sure to keep the flow of golden wheat and green bell peppers and red bell peppers going. There's always going to be those who'll make sure of that against all odds. Thanks, bye for now.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight. Advertising needs to be controlled and changed to reduce its impact on the climate, according to a report released as consumers prepare to spend billions of dollars on Black Friday. The report by the New Weather Institute think tank and the charity We Are Possible examines how advertising indirectly contributes to climate change and the ecological emergency. The study has found that the advertising industry promotes materialism and lifts sales of climate-harming products. The article you're about to hear has been written by The Guardian journalist Sandra Laville. The piece is titled, Rein in Advertising to Help Tackle Climate Crisis, Report Urges. Stay with us for more of Sandra Laville's article. Advertising needs to be controlled and changed to reduce its impact on the climate, according to a report released as consumers prepare to spend billions of dollars on Black Friday. The report by the New Weather Institute think tank and the charity We Are Possible examines how advertising indirectly contributes to climate change and the ecological emergency. The study has found that the advertising industry promotes materialism and lifts sales of climate-harming products. Researchers say the promotion of consumerism, materialism, and a work-and-spend cycle, and the industry's role in pushing sales of beef, tobacco, high-polluting, sports utility vehicles, and flights are all part of that indirect role. The report says the advertising industry has so far escaped scrutiny about its role in contributing to climate change. Tim Kasser, an emeritus professor of psychology at Knox College in Illinois, who co-authored the report, said there was a body of evidence to show that in order to make progress in addressing and reversing climate change and ecological degradation, it will be prudent to rein in and change the practices of the advertising industry. This report argues that enough sound empirical evidence exists to support the conclusion that the advertising industry indirectly contributes to climate change and ecological degradation through its encouragement of materialistic values and goals, the consumption-driven work and spend cycle, and the consumption of two illustrative products, namely beef and tobacco, Kasser wrote. The researchers examined several studies linking exposure to advertising with increased materialism. They say such exposure heightens the priority of people placed on materialistic values and goals and is associated with negative ecological attitudes and unsustainable behaviors. The desire to work longer hours in order to consume more is also laid at the door of advertising. Advertising leads people to place higher value on consumption of what they see advertised and lower value on having more time available for non-work activities, the report says. The advertising industry also encourages the purchase of products that have a negative impact on the environment, such as beef and tobacco. Numerous studies make it clear that raising cattle for beef relies on unsustainable water usage, causes destruction of habitat, habitat-providing and carbon-capturing forests, and emits high levels of both greenhouse gases and chemicals such as phosphorus and nitrogen that cause excessive growth of algae in bodies of water, the report says. Tobacco production also has a direct impact on the environment. Each stage in the life cycle of a cigarette, from growing the tobacco to manufacturing the cigarette to smoking the cigarette to disposing of the cigarette, is associated with specific climate and ecological risks. Deforestation, chemical pollution of water and soil, carbon dioxide and other noxious emissions. Tim Kasser said the correlation between the advertising of tobacco and its consumption was strong enough to have led the World Health Organization to call for a comprehensive ban on tobacco advertising to reduce its consumption. Stephen Woodford, chief executive of the Advertising Association, said, "Banning advertising of certain parts of the economy is not the answer. Applying pressure on systemic change in the way an industry operates is, and recognizing that advertising itself will make the best contribution to climate action by helping promoting these critical changes to people and encourage rapid behavioral change. At the same time, our own industry needs to make sure its operations have a real net zero impact, which is why we have launched Ad Net Zero to reduce the carbon impact of the development, production and distribution of advertising to real net zero by end of 2030. This includes the goal of encouraging advertisers and agencies, advertising agencies, to measure the carbon impact of their campaigns, which is a good and proven first step towards reduction of our impact on the environment.
Face-to-face. Dear listeners, what you hear now is an interview with Sudanese Information Minister Faisal Mohamed Saleh about ongoing developments in that country.
Thank you for joining us. Thank you for taking the time out of your busy schedule to speak to me. It's been 2 years since the Sudanese revolution, since the protests began. What do you think has been the main challenges, and have people's lives significantly changed since the revolution?
I think that the transition itself, it's a challenge. It's a very big challenge for the government, for the Sovereign Council, and for the political parties. And if we study the experience of transitional period in many countries, it's always been a very difficult time, with a lot of challenges and obstacles. And we face the same challenges and obstacles here in Sudan. It was difficult even to change the mentality of the people, the ordinary people, the people in the civil service, in the governments, who used to be under dictatorship for, dictatorship for 30 years. And at the same time, we have the problems of also changes in the military side, in the security, in the police department, in the army, which they are now partners. So all these were the difficulties we are facing. Some of them are expected already. We expect to have such problems. Some of them are new ones. At the beginning of the revolution and before that, people were hoping that we are going to have a full civilian transitional government and transitional organs. No one expected such situation of multiple military and civilian. So this is a new challenge. We found ourselves in a position where the civilian are negotiating with the army and they should be both on board. We were not prepared for that. The political parties were not prepared for that. The FFC, which she led the revolution, were not prepared for that. So this was a de facto situation that you have to deal with it. So this has also created new problems. Since this government came, we are trying to deal with these difficulties and challenges. I think we have been successful in some of them, especially, for example, in the side of peace agreement. It was a success, although, of course, some of the armed movement are still out of this peace negotiation. We hope that they're going to join. And the main challenges, I think, was economic one. And I will say, frankly, we were not successful in that. We still have a lot of problems. We knew from the beginning that we are going to have a very difficult economy, the old regime, and we had some ideas that we are going to overcome this problem. Unfortunately, and again, frankly, I will say that we were not successful in overcoming this problem. We're still suffering. Part of it, I think, will be solved because of the lifting of the American sanctions. Part of it, not all of it. But at least it will open doors for investment. It will open door for Sudan to rejoin the international banking system, which is one of the problems we are facing. But this is now is the main challenge, that the economic one.
And something you mentioned was you did not anticipate joining the military. You was expecting a full civilian government.
Yes.
What happened? How have we got to this situation where we have this kind of partnership between the military and the civilian government?
What happened is that simply, that the army intervened when they knew that the revolution will continue. And I think they have reached to the point where they think that the old regime cannot continue. And maybe they were thinking of if a new regime came, then there will be some negative aspects, negative result on the army, so they decided to intervene. So it appeared at the beginning that they are intervening in favor of the civilians, the protesters. But of course, when they did that, they asked for a share of power. And I think this is expected and natural in such situations. We have the same experience in 1985, where also the army intervened in the last moment. And so they were part of the transitional government. It lasted only for 1 year. But this time here is 4 years. So I think when they intervened, when they took the power and they ousted the old regime, then the civilian FFC found themselves in a situation where they have to negotiate. And they came there, the African Union intervened, Ethiopia intervened, the mediators came in, and it was a situation, as I said, it's a de facto situation where you have to negotiate with the army. And it was from that day, 11th of April, 2019, people expected that the army will be on board with the civilian. The negotiation was what's the share of the army will be and what's the share of the civilians. And I think because of the balance of power, by that time we reached to this result. Again, maybe it was not anticipated, it was not the same, the type of civilian transition government that people were expected, but this is how things went. And so it started from August 2019, this civilian and military partnership.
And it's a process, the transitional period is a process, and at the end of the process, the hope and the aim is for a democratically elected government.
Yes.
But what's to say the army doesn't do the same thing again, and they once again try to share power with a democratically elected government?
I think that will depend on the balance of power. Because we have this, what we call a constitutional declaration, and the constitutional declarations put an end to the military participation by the end of the transitional period, where we should finish the constitution, the new constitution, and we are going to have an election, and of course a new democratic government will take control. And the army will go back to the barracks, will be just doing what the army in the other countries do. This is what the constitutional declaration and the political agreement agreed upon. And I think everything depends on this balance of power. Because if the civilians are weak, then maybe the army will have new ideas. But day after day, there is a progress on that.
And we've traveled to many places on our trips. And one of the places we went to is Mayo, one of the poorest neighborhoods in Khartoum. It seems like the economically disenfranchised, which seems to be getting larger, it seems to be growing. What message can the Transitional Council give to them about economic prosperity in the future, or at least uplifting them from the economic situation that they're in?
That is linked to two issues. One of them is political, and the other one is economic. Political one is peace. Most of the people who are living in these areas came from the war-affected areas, and they are live in the margins of the big cities. And also, they don't have, some of them, most of them don't have a skill. They were not educated, so they are doing marginal jobs. And I think if we successful enough in implementing the peace agreement, most of these people will go back to their areas, where they are farmers or whatever the profession they have, and they resettle in their own areas where they have at least some peace and stability. That I think will improve the economic situation of them, because as I said, they will not be in the margin of their own life. They will be in the center of the life they are used to do, to live in the past. So this is the political side, that if we have enough peace and stability and security in the war-affected area, people will go back to these areas and live ordinary life. The other side is the economic one. As I said, we were not successful in that till now, because we promised people of working on sustainable development, and that we are trying to find way where the people will at least find education, health care, without spending a lot of money on that. That will be the government responsibility. And we still, although we promised to start from day one to do that, we didn't fulfill this for them. Because I think most of the problems they have is with education and health care. They are spending a lot of money on that, although they don't have enough money to do that. So this is part of the program the government promised to do, to work on it: free education for all people of Sudan, and free basic health care. And that, as I said, because we were not successful in pulling the country from this economic crisis, we still couldn't do that. I think, as I said again, when with these lifting sanctions, the American sanction of Sudan, now we will be open for receiving help and fund from international finance institution that will help improving the country. Also, I think we are going to receive a lot of investment. Sudan is rich with its resources, natural resources, that will open door for investors. And rejoining the international banking system will also attract investors. I think with new investments, that will help improving the situation in the country, and will improve the situation in these war-affected areas and the marginal areas.
So you mentioned the delisting of Sudan from the state sponsor of terror. Many international observers say that had less to do with the compensation offered to American victims of terror and more to do with Sudan agreeing to normalize relations with Israel. What was your response?
At the beginning, that was not the case. We have started from day one. In September 2019, the negotiation with the Americans on the political and legal side of this case of delisting Sudan from state sponsoring terrorism, and the compensation for the families of the victims of terrorist act that Sudan, the old Sudan government, was linked to. And the issue of normalizing relationship with Israel was never, by that time, was never mentioned. We started, as I said, in September 2019. So the negotiation went on the political side with the American administration and with the victims' families, the legal side. And that went on for maybe 7 or 8 months. And it went on successfully until we reached the point where we reduce the amount of money that the Sudan government will pay for the as a compensation for the victims' families. In the last few months since then, the question of normalization with Israel was raised. And what was not raised only with Sudan, as you may see, with Emirates, with Bahrain, with other countries. And we insisted on two things, that separation of the two issues. We used to say to them, and that was said to Secretary of State Bami when he came to Sudan, that these are two separate issues. Delisting Sudan from SST, we are negotiating on that in 7 or 8 months. Normalization with Israel is a very controversial issue. It could be discussed, of course. It's no problem that in discussing it in Sudanese media or discussion with the public, whatever it is, it could be discussed. But separated from the delisting of Sudan from SST, this is number one. Number two, our response to him was that we are a transitional government. This issue is not one of our mandate. And that is what we agreed upon in the civilian government with the FFC. We had a joint meeting before a day before he came, and we agreed that this is not a part of our mandate as a transitional government. This should be left to an elected government to discuss it. Then the American pressure on Sudan started. Until that time, he didn't say that it was linked, the delisting with the normalization. But he used to raise it, the issues. Until maybe the last 2 weeks before the American election. And I think it was Sudan was used as a card in the elections. Trump wanted to have some cards in his favor. Part of it is convincing some Arab countries to normalizing relationship with Israel. So it was linked directly. Sudan was put under a very heavy pressure. In the last week, it was said clearly, this is linked. If you want Sudan to be listed, delisted from the SST, then you have to normalize the relationship with Israel. It was a very difficult situation. And the economic expert, our economics expert, our economic minister said that Sudan cannot tolerate the sanction for 7 or 2 months after election. If we said no, then we will wait for the election, then the new administration will have 6, 7, 8 months until they have done all the heavy duty that they are supposed to do, the homework, until they can discuss things with Sudan. This is a very long time Sudan cannot tolerate. So the government had to do that, had to promise that they are going to normalize the relationship with Israel, but there was one condition. The whole issue will go to the Legislative Council. The Legislative Council is supposed to be established in a few weeks, that the whole issue of normalizing relationship with Israel will go to the Legislative Council. If it is approved by the Legislative Council, then the formal step will start. So that was the agreement until the election. We all watched what happened in the American election. And now I think that the issue of delisting will go on because the Democrats in the Congress approved it before even the election. So there was no problem in delisting Sudan from that. We are confident that this issue will go on successfully. The only issue still left is Sudan should be given some type of immunity from future cases, because compensation to these families, maybe that it will open door for some other families. And some of the senators have raised the issue of September 11 victims. They said that some of the families want also to sue Sudan. So this will be something that endless process. And we have said many times, even in the agreement, when we signed the agreement to pay the compensation for the families of Sudan, actually Sudanese people have nothing to do with terrorism. And that was an act of an ousted government. And it is not fair that Sudanese people should continue paying the price of that, for that, because the old regime hurt Sudanese people more than they hurt the American or the people of other countries. So we shouldn't pay the price twice. We have paid the price for 30 years. And now there is a new democratic government. It is suffering to try to take the country in the transitional process. It should be helped by the whole world and by the American administration not to be punished for crime committed by the old regime. We hope that the new administration will be open. We are also optimistic that the new administration will consider that. At least the Democrats say that they are more concerned with the democracy and human rights in the world. And I think if they want to present Sudan as a model for the region, they should help Sudan improving the situation of human rights and democracy. And that, of course, will be one of the conditions if you want to promote democracy in the region, to help the new democratic regime like Sudan.
And do you think the economic situation, the long queues for bread, for fuel, do you think that was used by the Americans as a negotiation tactic to force Sudan to normalize relations?
I cannot say that directly, but at least they didn't help Sudan to overcome such problems. It was not created by the Americans, maybe they are not used directly, but at least the Sudan was not helped in trying to overcome these economic problems.
And one of the issues that has come up is accountability. One of the most infamous parts of the revolution was the June the 3rd massacre. Yet when I've spoken to different people, they have very little hope that there'll ever be accountability for those that ordered the killings. What would you say to those people?
We are working hard on that. It's a very difficult task. Very, very difficult task. We have formed an independent committee to investigate what happened on the 3rd of June, and it's working with difficulties. And they have asked for extension for they were given 3 months, and then they asked for extension for 3 months, and now we are in the third extension of the 3 months. They are complaining of that they have almost about 3,000 witnesses. They have listened to 3,000 witnesses. They have hundreds of videotapes that they are looking and try to verify. And the task is very difficult. They are facing a very difficult time. They are working in a very difficult situation, and we understand that. And we try to explain that to the people. It is not an easy task. It needs some time. We should give them the time they ask for, so that when they finish their reports, the reports will be a very convincing report. So they have to spend the time they ask for. This is one thing. But in other cases, there is now ongoing trials on some of the martyrs of the revolution. Said there is now about 5 trials going on in Al-Ubayyid and here in Khartoum, in Al-Hasahisa. Those are people killed during the revolution. And fortunately, at least the people who committed the crime were identified. And this is one of the problems. Many people killed and you cannot identify who did that. But on those cases where the people are identified, they are now on trials. It is maybe a slow process. But I think this is the type of justice we want to do. We want a full trial. We want the ordinary judicial system to do that. We didn't have a special court for such things as the old regime used to do. And we give full right to those accused to have lawyers, to have time for their lawyers to examine the case. So this is how justice is done. I know it is sometimes slow, and maybe the people don't like that. They want to find a very fast trial, but I think fast trial will not be a just trial. A bit patient for justice to be done. At the same time, people want to cooperate, because you know, in many cases, that is on trial. The court, sometimes they don't have enough evidence. So we call on people who have some information to come and appear on this course and to give their information that they have. Maybe it is slow, we know that. Also, one of the problems, we have problems with the Attorney General's office. He's always complaining of not having enough people to work with them. We have people with the judicial, we have problems with the judicial system, which also inherited from the old regime, but we are working hard to deal with these problems.
And my final question, those that look at what's going on in Sudan argue that Sudan is being influenced by regional actors. Sudan plays a pivotal role in the Saudi-led war on Yemen, and there's clearly Saudi and Emirati influence within the military council. How does Sudan chart an independent foreign policy while these regional actors have such vested interest in the Republic of Sudan?
That's true. I mean, part of this situation was inherited. For example, the involvement of Sudanese army in Yemen was inherited from the old regime, and we are trying to find way to finish that. We are concerned with what happened in Yemen. We are also concerned with what's happening in Saudi Arabia. But involving directly in a war is not the right thing to do, and to help the situation to be solved, the crisis in Yemen. We have a very long relationship with Saudi Arabia, but at the same time, we don't think sending army is the right way to help Saudi or Saudi Arabia or to help Yemen. So we are trying to deal with such situation, at least to reach a point where we can pull the Sudanese army from Yemen and try to play a positive role in solving the crisis in Yemen. And you know what's happening in Libya, what's happening in South Sudan, what is happening now in Ethiopia. We are living in a very difficult areas in the world, very difficult situation where the countries around Sudan have a lot of problems. And that puts Sudan within different axes. From day one, we say that we want Sudan to be independent and we to have independent foreign policies, but also that cannot happen in a moment. We are aware of that. We are aware that Sudan is considered part of the Saudi Emirates acts. We want Sudan to be very independent in its foreign policy and having a normal relationship with all countries. And now I think the relationship with Qatar has improved a bit, and we hope that we are going to improve it more so we can have the normal relationship with all countries. But one of the main thing people of Sudan ask for is this foreign independent foreign policy. And I think during the transition we are moving, maybe slowly, but we are moving towards that.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
This is part of a speech delivered on September 21st, 2020 by Ayatollah Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, via video conference with participants in ceremonies throughout the country to honor the veterans of the Sacred Defense Era. The meeting was held on the occasion of 40th anniversary of the Sacred Defense.
You should not underestimate the coronavirus. Well, as you see, the officials in charge are really sacrificing themselves. Physicians, nurses, managers, and others are all working hard. Therefore, we should